No, you can interrupt me, you know, whatever. I get bored of listening to myself. Anyway, the title of the paper is A General Theory of Matching Estimation, and this is a joint work with Hido Ingens. Okay, so let me start with some motivation. Well, you all know that the matching methods are very popular in statistical data analysis. We use them for many things. We use them for covariate adjustment. We use them to estimate treatment effects under some, you know, ignorability or unconfoundedness or whatever you want to call it. And we use them for the analysis of the missing data. And there they go under the name of Hogg-Deck imputation. I'm not sure if you know this, but you know, 30% of the earnings in the CPS, the current population survey in the United States, are imputed. They are not real data. They are imputed by Hogg-Deck imputation. Okay? These matching methods are, you know, have a lot of intuitive appeal. They are very easy to use, and they are very popular. But the problem of deriving the distribution of these estimators in large samples, even in large samples, is basically unsolved, except for some particular cases. And in particular, in a previous paper, we established a distribution of matching estimators for the case in which we match with replacement and we use a fixed number of matches per unit. Okay. But many people do not match with replacement. They match with a replacement. And some people, they don't use a fixed number of matches per unit. Okay? And some people don't even match directly on the covariates. They match on the propensity score that they have to estimate in the first step. And we don't know how to calculate the standard errors for that. But everybody's doing it. Okay? So, empirical researchers, in the absence of analytical results about the distribution of matching estimators, many of them have been used in the bootstrap. But recently, we have shown also that in general the bootstrap is not valid. Okay, that's bad news too. Okay, so this is the state of affairs as of today, basically, and this is what I want to discuss today in the presentation. The first thing the presentation is going to have two parts. In the first part, I'm going to propose a template to analyze the properties to derive the large sample distribution of matching estimators, and this is going to work basically for any matching estimator where you match directly on the covariates, okay? But as I said before, many people do not match directly on the covariates; they match on the propensity score, but they don't know the propensity score. They have to estimate it in a first step, and they don't know how to adjust. Their standard errors for the fact that they are estimating, the propensity score in the first step. So the second part of the talk will be about that. It will be about how to adjust the standard errors for first step estimation of the propensity score. Okay. So as you can see, this comes from two papers. The first one is called a martingale representation of matching estimators. There, what we saw is that under some conditions. In large samples, matching estimators behave like martingales. Okay, and this is good news because then we can use all the battery of limit methods for martingales to analyze the properties of matching estimators. Okay, and in that paper also as an illustration, we derive the asymptotic distribution of matching estimator when we match without replacement. That, as far as we know, is a result that is previously unavailable in the literature. Okay, and the second paper is about how to adjust. Your standard errors for first step estimation of the propensity score. Okay, so let me introduce some notation. This is quite conventional. W is going to be a binary variable, like a treatment. For example, an indicator for female worker. Y is going to be an outcome, for example, labor wages. And X is going to be a vector of covariates. Let's say, a job and worker characteristics. So this is an example of that comes from, litigation research. Okay, and we want to estimate a parameter like this, that is the, average earnings for women minus this expectation that the interpretation of this is that the average earnings for men, if men have the same distribution in the covariates as women. Okay, so we are going to compare these two expectations. And as you all know, You know, in evaluation research, this parameter tau has a causal interpretation as the average effect of the treatment on the treated and their zone unconfounded in the sensation. But even if you are not talking about it, if you are not thinking about it, you know, estimating causal effect, you may be thinking about estimating this parameter by matching. Okay? So I'm going to focus in, you know, like in this parameter just, you know, to avoid, you know, like a tedious repetition or, you know, unnecessary abstraction. But, you know, like, you know, what I say apply, you know, to other, you know, any other matching estimator of a functional, of a, you know, of the distribution of data. And you will see why in a second. In a few minutes, okay? So we are going to have like two samples, a sample of untreated of size N0 and a sample of treated of size N1, and N is going to be the, you know, the N0 plus N1, okay? And this is the you know, this is the typical matching estimator that we use. So for, you know, like for each treated individual, we have the outcome for the treated individual minus the average outcome for, you know, all the matches. Okay, and here we are using a fixed number of matches, M. Okay? And JMI is the set of M matches for observation I. Okay, and how we choose JMI? Well, for matching with replacement, it's very simple. It's just the closest M observation in the non-treated group. Okay, for matching without replacement, it's a little bit more difficult. It's, you know, the JMIs are the non-overlapping subsets of the set of untreated individuals, usually chosen to minimize some, you know, aggregate of the matching discrepancies. Okay, so this is, but this is not the only way to do matching. Like many people do, like they do full matching, they do like subclassification methods, they do like a genetic matching, like yes, like a synthetic matching. There are many ways to do matching. Okay, and as you will see, like the results that are going to discuss apply to all these, you know, all these different ways to confront the problem. Okay, so as I told you before, you know, I will try to convince you that, you know, in large samples, like matching estimators behave like martingales. So let me spend like a few minutes, you know, reminding you about, you know, what is a martingale and what is a martingale array and so on. So like, imagine that you have like a sequence of a random variable CK, and you have an increasing sequence of sigma algebras that we call a filtration. And CK is going to be a martingale with respect to FK if, you know, if it is adapted and if, you know, the expectation of CK conditional on the value of this of the filtration, the previous value of the filtration is equal to CK minus 1. Okay, so like that's the idea of the martingale, like you know, the expectation of the martingale tomorrow conditional on the information today is the value of the martingale today. Okay, so like you can always express martingales as, you know, sums of martingale differences. And then all these martingale differences have mean zero conditional on the previous value of the filtration. Okay? And then what is a martingale array? It's just, you know, a bunch of martingales that you stack, you know, one on top of each other. That's very simple. Okay, and why martingales are interesting? Well, for many reasons, but one of them is that under some conditions, martingales in large samples tend to behave like normal variables. Okay, so here is like a theorem. There are many results, you know, in this literature. But this one possible result: if you take, you know, the conditional variances of you know, like all the martingale differences, I sum all of them, and this converges to some number sigma square. And also, if you have like some Lindeberg condition that holds, then you can show that the martingale converges to a normal with mean zero and variance sigma square. Okay, that's well-known result. Okay, so is this? Okay, so let me try to start like the derivation of why, you know, like matching estimators behave like martingales. I'm going to introduce notation. Mu wx is going to be the regression of y on x and w. Okay, and in a previous paper we have shown that if you take a matching estimator and subtract the estimate, and this is equal to these two terms, dn and rn. Okay? Dn is going to have mean zero because here we have the two regression functions and we are subtracting the, you know, the average treatment effect on the treated. And here we have, you know, a sum of a bunch of regression errors. So both this and this are going to have mean zero. So if our matching estimator has some bias, the bias is going to come from this term Rn. Okay, so this, what is Rn about? Rn is what we call the conditional bias of the matching estimator. And if you look at it, you will realize that this is going to be zero under two conditions. One is like it's going to be zero if you are able to have always perfect matches. Because if you have always perfect matches, like xi is equal to xj, and, you know, and all these like you know regressions cancel, and you don't have bias. So the matching estimator doesn't have bias because you are matching exactly everybody. Okay. The other situation in which you know this is going to be zero if is the trivial case in which the regression functions are flat, because if the regression functions are flat, you know everybody is a good match for anybody, and you know like you can match at random and you are doing well. Okay. But more generally, this is not going to be zero. You know, the matching estimator is going to include a bias, and the order of magnitude of Rn is going to depend on two things. It's going to depend on the number of continuous covariates, and it's going to depend on the size of n0 relative to n1. So if you have many covariates, you know that matching, because of the course of dimensionality, the matching discrepancies will go to zero very, very slowly. Okay, and then like this, the difference between these regressions will go to zero very, very slowly. Okay, but of course, if you allow me to have as many untreated observations as I want, you know, I can make these matching discrepancies very, very small, right? So, like, it's going to depend on these two, on these two things. Okay. So you can show in a case you can show that under certain conditions, like root n1 times the conditional bias converges in probability to zero, and we have shown that you know previously for you know matching with replacement. And you know, in this presentation, like if I have time, in the paper now we have a result for matching word replacement. If you think about it, it's always harder to make the conditional bias go to zero for matching without replacement than for matching word replacement. Okay. So let's think now about this other term, dn. Okay. Remember that here I have like a bunch of regression error. And I want to express dn like in fact this second average in a different way. What I'm going to do, you know, if you think about this, you know, the regression error for each treated individual appears in this average once, and for each untreated individual appears, well, as many times as this untreated individual is used so much, divided by m. Okay, so I'm going to define k and I as the number of times that observation I is used so much. And this dn, like in fact, you know, you can see that the second average is equal to this. It's equal to, you know, like the regression error for a treated individual appears one. For an untreated individual appears, you know, the number of times that these untreated individuals use so much divided by m. Okay? So this k and I, if you are matching without replacement, is going to be either 0 or 1, right? And you, if you are matching with replacement, maybe 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Okay, so the following thing that I want to do, as you can see, I have here two averages that go from, you know, from 1 to n. And so I'm going to put these two sums in a big sum that goes from 1 to 2 times n. Okay, so this is what I'm going to do. Like, I'm going to multiply everything by root n 1. So I have that root n 1 times dn is equal to, you know, this sum that goes from, that has like 2 times n, you know, like components, and, you know, they come, you know, from the formulas in the previous slide. Okay, and if you have been paying attention, you realize that you know my notation for these terms are exactly the same as the notation that I was using for the martingale differences, right? And this, of course, not a coincidence. It's because you know I'm going to you know show that these guys are martingale differences, in fact, right? But are martingale differences with respect to what? Well, with respect to certain filtration, and I'm free to, you know, construct the filtration in, you know, any way I want. So this is the way that I'm going to do it. So my filtration is going to be like a, you know, like an increasing, you know, sequence of sigma algebras, like from 1 to 2n. Okay, for the first, you know, n sigma algebras are going to be generated by, you know, like all the treatment assignments, and, you know, like all the values of the covariates up to observation k. Okay, after n plus 1, I'm going to define my sigma algebra as the one generated by all the treatment assignments, all the covariates, and all the outcomes until you know k minus n. Okay, so like this is my filtration, and you know this is what I had in the previous slide, and you know like if you this is the sequence of you know random variables that I have in the previous slide, and if you look at it you know carefully, you know like you will realize you know immediately that this is like this adapted to this filtration. So the only thing that I need to do in order to convince you that these are martingale. That these are martingale differences is to show that this conditional expectation is equal to zero. Okay? For the first n terms, this is going to be very easy because all these observations are independent, and I have the regression of y on x and w equal to 1 minus the regression of y on x and w equal to 0. But here I have the average effect of the treatment for the treated, so this has mean zero. Okay, the second n terms is a little bit more difficult, but you will see how it works. I mean, let's think about this parenthesis. Let's forget about the regression error. Okay, so in this parenthesis, here I have the treatments, but the treatments are included in my sigma algebra, right? Like I have all of them. And here I have, the number of times that each observation is used so much. But the number of times that each observation is used so much depends only on the treatment assignments and the values of the covariates. So if you give me all the treatment assignments and all the values of the covariates, KNI is fixed. So this will go, like outside the conditional expectation. And now I have the conditional expectation of this second parenthesis. Well, this guy is also is given conditional FNK minus 1 because both, the treatment and the covariates are included in the filtration. But then I have the expectation of y, k minus n, conditional on this, conditional on all the treatments, and conditional on all the treatments, all the covariates, and all the outcomes up to k minus n minus 1. Okay, but because all observations are independent, the conditional expectation of this guy, the expectation of this guy conditional on FNK minus 1 is going to be exactly the same as this, and this is going to be, the whole thing is going to have been zero. Okay, so basically what I thought is that this is a martingale, relative to this filtration. Okay, the interesting thing about this result is that it holds no matter how you match. I mean, you can match with replacement, without replacement, with a fixed number of matches, with a variable number of matches, but no matter how you match, the number of times that each unit is used so much is fixed, is given condition on all the covariate values and all the treatment assignments. And this conditional expectation is always zero because it doesn't depend on your matching scheme. So the martingale representation of the n is going to hold, for any matching estimator. Okay? So that's what I say here, an always martingale representation hold for an alternative matching estimators. So this is going to suggest a way to derive conditions under which any matching estimator that is matching directly on the axis is going to be normally distributed in large samples. The first thing that you have to do is to establish the conditions for a martingale central limit theorem for the Dn part, and second, establish the conditions under which the conditional bias term goes to zero. By the way, I didn't say it, but if you go back here and you are thinking about a matching scheme that randomize among matches, this is going to also be covered in this result, because at some point you can include in the filtration all the realization of all your randomization experiments. Okay, let me talk a little bit about how to apply this to matching without replacement. So as I said before, this is the way in which we choose them. The matching sets, we minimize some, aggregate matching discrepancies, and all these matching sets do not overlap. Okay, but we don't have previous result on the large sample properties of this class of estimators, although many people use, matching without replacement. So here we are going to apply these martingale methods that I just explained to study the large sample properties of these estimators. And to make everything simple, I'm going to assume that, we only use one match, and conditional on W, the variance of Y is constant. Okay. So the first thing that we have to do, like the, you know, to apply the, you know, the Martingale central limit theorem, is I have to show that the, you know, all these conditional variances converge. Okay, but you know, in my toy sample in which you have homothesticity, this is very easy because if you make the calculation, you will see that, you know, the sum of the conditional variances is constant and does not depend on n. It's, you know, it's the average of the, you know, conditional treatment effect for the treated plus the sum of the residual variances. Okay, so the only thing that you need to that is need to be done, you know, in order to solve them, you know, like asymptotic normality of this symmetry is to establish the Lindenberg condition. You know, like this is usually a little bit difficult to attack the Lindenberg condition like directly, but it's very easy to show that, you know, the Lindenberg condition is implied by the Lyapunov condition. So like the only thing that you need for this to hold is you need to have like certain bounded moments. Okay, so under usual regularity conditions, you can apply, you can establish the Lindenberg condition, and then you will see that, you know, the first term of the matching estimator like converges in distribution to in converges to normal distribution with mean zero and variance sigma squared, and sigma squared is in the previous slide. Yeah.
What are you using to get the bounded moments to verify the Lyapunov condition?
Yeah, basically you
what
need
information?
That. What do you mean? What information?
Well, what do you need in your
No, this is basically a regularity condition. It does not depend on the way that you match. You know, you need to have that, you know, certain moments of certain variables exist. Okay.
So, and how do you get that in general?
How do you get that the second moment exists for the central limit theorem? We don't know. Like, we hope that they do. Like, we think that for most variables, like a, you know, like a second moment exists, and here we are going to have the same.
So
I mean, you cannot design. You could do that, but then you are going to change the parameter that you are estimating, because you are not going to estimate the average effect of the treatment on Y. You are going to estimate the average effect of the treatment on some trim version of Y.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, if Y is bounded, for example, it's going to happen. That's you know, then all moments exist. But in general, the very simple central limit theorem, the most simple central limit theorem, requires that you have second moments. Here, this is going to require that we have second moments plus something.
And
yeah, small. Yeah. Okay. So to conclude my proof, like I have to show you that and that the conditional bias goes to zero fast enough. Okay. And so this is the conditional bias. This is another regularity condition that they will have to assume, but this is like you need this for matching, is that you know that these regression functions are Lipschitz continuous. Because if these regression functions are Lipschitz continuous, then the normalized conditional bias is proportional to the average matching discrepancy multiplied by root n1. Okay? And you know, like under some conditions you can show that this holds, in fact, the conditions that are much, much weaker than what I have here. The only condition that I think is like is very important is this one here, is that, you know, k, remember that the k is the number of continuous covariates. So for if you have like k continuous covariates, you need r that is bigger than k, such that n1 to the power of r divided by n0 is bounded. Okay, so that is telling you that even when you are matching in one dimension, you need that the order of magnitude of the control group has to be bigger than the order of magnitude of the treatment group. And if you increase, you know, the number of dimensions in which you are matching, like, you know, this difference has to be larger. Okay.
What was Lipschitz? I missed what was Lipschitz.
What?
You, in the previous slide, you said something was Lipschitz.
Yeah. The regression functions. And this is the regression of y on x and w equal to zero. Okay, so like in a. The regression of the outcome on. Okay. And I need that this is Lipschitz in x. Because otherwise matching doesn't make sense, right? Because you can maybe matching like individuals that are very close in the covariates, but the regression functions are very far apart. Then, you know, if you're in that type of situation, you don't want to match, right? Okay, so this is the first part of the talk, and what I just thought is that, you know, like any type of matching estimator, as long as you match directly on the covariates, even if you randomize some of the matches, you can apply this machinery. The problem is that many people do not match directly on the covariates. They match on the propensity score, but they don't know the propensity score, and they have to estimate it in a first step. Okay, so the second part of the talk is going to be about how to calculate standard errors, valid standard errors, when you are matching on the estimated propensity score. You don't know the propensity score in the first step, you estimate the propensity score, and then you do match. Okay? So PI is going to be my propensity score. I'm going to assume that it's something like a logit or a probit or something like that. I'm going to have a parametric propensity score. And this is the estimated propensity score. And if I try to apply the machinery of the first part of the talk, you know, I end up with at the end that is like this. Now the regression function has a bar here because it's not the regression of y on x and w, it's the regression of y on the propensity score on w. It's a different regression function. Okay. So this looks very promising, but the problem is that the Martingale representation is going to fail. Why? Because the first part is the first ingredient that we need is going to be good, because still when you are matching on the estimated propensity score, the number of times that this unit is used as a match depends only on all the treatment assignments and all the covariate values. Because if you give me all the treatment assignments and all the covariate values, all the estimated propensity score are fixed. Okay? However, this second part is going to fail. Why? Because I have, the expectation of y, minus the regression on the propensity score, but here I'm conditioning on, all the x's on the w's and the previous values of the outcome. And so this expectation is the regression on the x's minus the regression on the propensity score. And this is, in general, this is not zero, right? So this is not going to be a martingale. It's going to be zero only under two circumstances. The first one is that a condition on the propensity score, there is only one value for the covariates, okay? And then, conditioning on the propensity score and conditioning on the covariates is exactly the same, and these two regression functions are the same. But this is the situation in which the propensity score doesn't give you dimension reduction. I mean, like, you have the same dimension problem with or without the propensity score. The second case in which this is going to be zero is you may have many x's, but conditioned on the propensity score, all the regression values are exactly the same. So conditioned on the propensity score, this regression function is flat. Okay? That's not very likely to happen. Okay, so that's the problem. We cannot apply the previous part of the talk, so we try to do something different. Okay, so this is what we are going to do. Like, the first thing that I'm going to do to make things easy for me, I'm going to change the parameter of interest. Now I'm going to talk about the average effect of the treatment on population. The average effect of the treatment on treatment is a little bit more difficult because it depends on the propensity score. But the average effect of the treatment on the population does not depend at all on the propensity score. Okay? And we are going to estimate the propensity score in the first step. We are going to match on the estimated propensity score. And I'm going to assume that in the first step, we estimate the propensity score by maximum likelihood. I could do exactly the same with an inefficient first step estimator, but it's a little bit longer. OK? You'll see.
You're not trying to smooth.
It's a regular parametric model. Yeah.
It's true.
Like, isn't it? It's true, yeah?
Yeah, right.
So this is the matching estimator of the average effect of the treatment, right? Yeah, so. And more generally, theta n hat, tau n hat theta is going to be the estimator that matches on, the propensity score evaluated at theta for any value of theta. And tn theta is going to be the normalized estimator after you subtract you subtract tau and you multiply by root n. And please remember this tn because it's going to appear quite a lot. Okay? So this is a two-step estimator. In the first step, we estimate the propensity score. In the second step, we plug in the propensity score to, estimate the average treatment effect. And how do we usually try to establish the large sample distribution of the two-step estimators? Well, in this way. We usually try to establish this expansion in which, this is the normalized estimator. On the estimated propensity score is equal to the estimator, on the true value of the parameter plus on, you know, adjustment term. And once you have this, you know, like getting asymptotic normality is quite easy. The problem is that we don't know how to get this. This is too difficult for us. I mean, like we are not smart enough. Why? Because the propensity, the matching is a very non-smooth function of the distribution of data. So it's very, we don't know how to establish this kind of expansion. So what we are going to do, we are going to bypass this. We are going to try to, you know, like establish asymptotic normality directly without establishing this expansion. Okay? And you will see how. And we are going to follow like an alternative approach that is was proposed by Andrew and Worker to think about the distribution of two-step estimators. Okay, so how is this? Like, you know, P theta is going to be the distribution of my variables. You know, this is theta is the parameters of the propensity score, and I'm going to consider a local alternative to this distribution. And now, like instead of F theta, I'm going to have theta n, and theta n is theta plus some vector delta divided by root n. So this goes to theta. Okay, and this lambda is the log likelihood ratio between p theta and p theta n. Okay, one of the things that you can prove, and there's some regularity conditions, you can prove that this log likelihood ratio you can expand in this way. Okay, and this guy here, I theta, this is the Fisher information matrix from the first step, and this guy here, delta n, and this is what we call like the central sequence of the first step. This is going to be normally distributed with mean zero and variance equal to the Fisher information matrix. This is if the estimator is a regular, you know, it's a regular parametric model. And so on. Okay. Okay, not only that, by the way, all this, you know, is happening under my sequence of local alternatives, okay? And also under my sequence of local alternatives, I can establish, you know, an expansion for the you know, parameters that I estimate in the first step that depend on the you know on the Fisher information matrix and the central sequence. Okay, so how are we going to proceed? So the first thing that we are going to know that we're going to do is we are going to show that our matching estimator that conditions on the propensity score evaluated at theta n. The vector that includes this and includes the central sequence under p theta, we saw that he has this normal distribution. This is relatively easy. I mean, you have to apply all the martingale results that we saw in the previous part of the presentation plus the Kramer word device. But it's relatively easy because you are still under p theta n, you are still matching on the true propensity score. Okay. And this is going to be important later, but I will discuss this later. Okay, so we have this result. Okay, so this is repetition of what we saw. We have this result. We have that the log likelihood ratio can be approximated this way. That depends on the central sequence and the parameters of the first step. You know, like we can establish this expansion that depends also on the central sequence. Okay, so when you put these three things together, you get like what is, you know, the joint distribution of Tn, the normalized estimator of the first step parameters, and the log likelihood ratio under p theta n. Okay, but now we have here like two random variables, and here we have another random variable that is what is the, it's the log likelihood ratio. So now we can apply Lecamster lemma. And applying the Lecamster lemma, we can get the distribution of these guys under p theta instead of under p theta n. So now this is interesting because this is telling us what happens when you are matching on something that is not the true propensity score. Okay? Still, it's not exactly what we want because we want to put here theta hat. But we have theta plus delta divided by n. Okay? But hold on a second. This is what we are going to do. We are going to calculate the distribution of Tn theta hat, okay? The limited distribution of Tn theta hat as the limited distribution of Tn theta plus delta divided by root n 1 conditional on theta plus delta divided by root n 1 equal to theta hat. Or, equivalently, theta hat minus theta multiplied by root n equal to delta. And we are going to integrate this over the over this distribution. And we can do it because we have the joint distribution of these two animals. Okay. There are like some delicate mathematical arguments that you have to do in order to do this integration, and then like take the limit. But this is what you obtain. You obtain that you know, matching the estimated propensity score, you get like a, you know, like a, you get a normal distribution with mean zero. This is the variance that you will obtain if you match on the true propensity score. This is the C that we were talking about before. This is the inverse of the Fisher information matrix. So this thing is positive definite. Okay, so like you know, matching on the estimated propensity score, you get asymptotically a smaller variance than matching on the true propensity score, which is in line with some of the results that we know. So the idea is now like, okay, so when this is not going to matter. So this is not going to matter when C is equal to zero. It's the only way in which we don't have to do an adjustment. Okay, so when is this, so we have C here. So C is going to be equal to zero when this covariance is equal to zero, right?
Can you explain that? It's too far. What is that covariance?
This is the covariance of X with the regression function, conditioned on the propensity score, and the treatment. Okay? The covariance between X and the regression, conditioned on the propensity score and the treatment. But think about it. This is going to be zero only in two cases. It's when, you know, conditioned on the propensity score, you know, there is no variation in X, or when conditioned on the propensity score, there is no variation in mu. These are exactly the two situations where we said before that, you know, like all that I did in the previous, you know, in the first part of the presentation could apply, and I don't have to adjust the standard errors for, you know, first step estimation of the propensity score. But in general, we have to adjust this, the standard errors. Okay, and this is about how to estimate the adjustment, but I think that I don't have time for this, so I won't go. But I want to show you the, the only thing that I want to say about this is that you don't need to, you know, like choose smoothing parameters as a function of the sample size. You can estimate this adjustment by matching, doing matching. Okay. Let me show you the results of a Monte Carlo design. So here I have like a 5,000 observations. Like I'm going to do one match. I have two covariates, x1 and x2, and the two of them are independent, are uniformly distributed between 0 and 1, and the propensity score is logistic. And here I have a lot of dimension reduction, because my value of the propensity score depends on x1 minus x2. So two different people may have very different characteristics, but the same propensity score. Okay. So these are simulations, and this is the variance. This is the variance of, you know, like the matching estimator on the true propensity score and the matching estimator on the estimated propensity score. Okay, and you can see that, you know, like, you know, when you match on the true propensity score, you get a, you know, much higher variance. Okay. Okay, so now what we have here is the estimator, the empirical estimator of the bias, the one that our researchers would use, because the researcher doesn't know the design of the Monte Carlo. I mean, doesn't know the data generating process. So for estimating this, we have forget about the data generating process and get our estimators of the variance. And this is the estimator of the variance for matching on the true propensity score. Okay, we're doing quite well. Okay, so this is the estimation of the variance. If you match on the estimated propensity score, but you say, you know, I'm going to assume that, you know, it's the true propensity score because I don't know how to do the adjustment. And then you go back to the same variance as before. And this is the variance when you do the adjustment that we propose. And then, like, you get exactly what you want. Okay, and if you look at this in, you know, in terms of, you know, coverage rates, like, you have that, you know, like, if you match on the true propensity score, and use the estimator of the variance with an adjustment, you do quite well. If you match on the true propensity score, but you know, like you proceed, sorry, on the estimated propensity score, but you proceed as if that is the true propensity score, you have basically coverage rate equal to one. And when you adjust and you match on the estimated propensity score, you adjust, you have like a, you know, like a, the right coverage rate. So let me conclude like a. So these two papers we do, I think that they're, we have a bunch of results there. We establish a martingale representation that allows us to use well-known martingale limit properties to analyze the distribution of matching estimators. So everything that you know about martingales, now you can use them for, you know, matching estimators. Like I talked today about estimating average treatment effect, but you can use exactly the same to analyze the properties of matching estimators of parameters that are estimated with hot deck imputation methods, and we do that all the time. Even if you don't do that, when you get the CPS, it's done there for you, okay? And an illustration of the applicability of the theory, we derived the asymptotic distribution matching estimator with matching is carried out with a replacement, a result that was previously unavailable in the literature. And finally, we propose a correction that produces a valid standard errors for propensity score matching estimator. This is a result that was also previously unavailable in the literature. Okay, so that's the paper. Thank you. It's the first time that someone told me in a seminar that what I did is cool. Okay, and then we're recording this, right?
You can dance. but the step. So this is completely technical. I'm just going to tell you something. You can look at it. So in the step where you, surprising to me, actually were conditioned on the an estimator, right? You establish something by going to the conditional distribution.
Yeah.
And you said it was delicate there or something.
It is.
So in this paper in JASA that I did with Vandervaart, we had to do that. And the way he said you had to do it to make it rigorous, he wrote about, and I don't know, he wrote about a page in the appendix, quoting these things from Lacan that I've never even heard about, where you have to discretize and do this.
Exactly, you're exactly right. You need a discretization step for the first step estimator, but you can discretize as much as you want, basically.
Okay, I know.
That's the way to technically prove that, but it's inconsequential for
what you know what the answer is.
Proving this is delicate, but you have to go to a discretization of it, because the only topologies in which these converges are discrete topologies is ugly, but the result is there. I mean, and we can use it.
Anything Where did else? You read that? You read the original Lacan?
No, because there are people like Ad that have read that for us.
I know, but I don't think he's. But I'm saying he didn't have any place of his own to reference this. He went to the original Lacan in this appendix of this paper.
For
analyzing something we conditioned on a.
That we didn't take from Lacan. We took from other sources. Sorry.
That's possible.
In fact, this is discussed in this paper that I mentioned. I don't know if you by Andre Owen Werker, and looking at them.
No, you're right. It's not.